Hello, and welcome to the Third Space Podcast, episode number 78, Mind Games. In this episode, Daniel and I discuss a video game idea I had one time about diving under the ocean, exploring sunken ruins, and a game that I picked up recently called Subnautica that kind of embodies that idea. So we talk about that for a while, how underwater controls work, how human computer interfaces work, how we actually use controllers to talk to machines. And that leads us into discussing something that's been in the news lately, Neuralink, the device that can be implanted into your brain that lets you communicate with computers. So we talk about the current state of that technology and then where it might go in the future, either in a utopian direction or a dystopian direction. It's a pretty fun and engaging conversation. So I hope you enjoy it. Welcome to the Third Space Podcast.
Thank you. I feel welcomed.
Good. Well, that was my intent. Mm. You know, in the past, I've mentioned this to you. I can't remember if we've talked about it on the podcast or not, but I had a really good idea for a video game. Maybe it's not unique to me, but it's something that I've never seen done quite well. And that idea is... Maybe it's post-apocalyptic, maybe it's otherworldly, but for whatever reason, a typical modern urban environment has been totally flooded, and you as the player have to explore the underground, you know, ruins of flooded urban landscape. Do you remember talking about this at some previous time?
I do, because my concern was water mechanics. That's always been a problem in video games. Just oftentimes they'll make it more just soupy or, and so like that would be pivotal to the enjoyment of the game. Yeah,
exactly. That's exactly right. You know, you can imagine the cool parts of a game like this would be, you know, the atmosphere would be pretty eerie. Seeing familiar sites, you know, like a kitchen or whatever, but underwater, you'd have to navigate the space differently. You know, normally when you...
It titillates the imagination. Anytime you mystify the familiar, I think that's what... I mean, either demystifying something that is mysterious or mystifying something that's so normal. So yeah, take an apartment, like, where you're swimming through some apartment, skyscraper, but floor by floor and like seeing everyday things underwater, upending my expectations on that would be really neat.
And there's a difference too, because, you know, in our typical day-to-day life, you know, we move essentially in a planar fashion, forward, backwards, left and right, and we don't move up and down, you know. But when you're underwater, of course, you are moving in three dimensions, not just in a two-dimensional plane.
Basically, for the most flying. Part But underwater. You are.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And so, you know, that you mentioned controls being a difficult challenge in that setting. And that's true, right? Because, you know, you imagine you're controlling a player character in space. You know, if you're playing Call of Duty or Halo or Splatoon or whatever, you're mostly just moving on a plane, you know, and so your left joystick can control the movement of the character on that 2D plane, and your right joystick can kind of control their look angle or whatever. But if you're swimming or flying, then you have to consider altitude and elevation, moving up and down. If you're flying, it's a little easier. You have a little bit of a cop-out because, you know, our current technology, airplanes move forward only, pretty much. So... You buy yourself a little bit of help with controls, although helicopter controls have notoriously been annoying in video games of the past. And if you have spaceships and hovercraft and that sort of thing, then, you know, you have to be creative with your controls.
I think that the idea, like, to me, if I take a kart racing game that's very arcadey, like arcade style versus something meant to mimic or replicate like real life, like a Gran Turismo, or what's the terminology when you're trying to replicate like a
simulation.
Yeah. Those are, I mean, the different audiences and different goals and different purposes. Like, I have no fun with those games where you have to actually slow down going around the curves and, like, you can't, you know, pull the L trigger and slide. Like, I want the arcade experience. And I think even, like, first-person shooters, I'm sure there's, like, some gritty realism, but you also want to move quickly and you want to be able to snap and, like do the things swiftly and... the reason you play video games is, like you said, you critique Grand Theft Auto for the hyper-realism. Like, I can already read a newspaper under the bridge that's discarded in real life. Like, I don't need the mechanics to resemble real life. I would think you would lean into some arcadey physics underwater, and you would not want, you know, real-life physics. So,
yeah. Yeah, I don't want to get pulled too far afield, but like on that topic, like, you know, imagine a driving game, like you mentioned, if we could capture, like, you know, we've driven cars and you've driven your car around a sharp turn at speed, some amount of speed before enough to feel it pull you into your seat. And you can develop a feel for how your car is going to respond to the forces of physics.
Yes.
When are your tires going to slip on the road? When, you know, how fast can you take a turn? How quickly can you accelerate or decelerate, et cetera? You can get a feel for that, and it's thrilling to drive a car. At least to me, anyway, I find it thrilling to drive a car, you know, pushing those boundaries a little bit. You know, nothing too reckless. I'm not out on a racetrack or anything, but I find it really fun to drive on a curvy mountain road, for example. And so I can
particularly if a car is designed for that, right?
Oh, like, yeah, like
a,
sure.
An SUV is a little more of a pain because it's like top heavy and weird feeling. But yeah, little sporty car, low to the ground. Well, yeah, I like it.
And so, you know, a game like Project Gotham Racing, if you remember, which was the first game that annoyed me. With this kind
of Xbox, the original one, incredible graphics, right? Like,
yeah, I mean, sure.
It would stand to this day, probably to some degree, anyway.
It looked great for the time, but it was not fun to play because it was a racing simulation, like you mentioned. And I think the reason why it wasn't fun wasn't because it attempted to realistically capture the physics of driving a car. It's because the feedback from the game to the player was just totally insufficient. You don't feel yourself getting pressed into the seat. You don't, you know, when you're pressing the joystick all the way to the left, it lacks the same sensation of turning your steering wheel all the way to the left when you're going around a turn. Like, if you've ever driven your car around a sharp turn, you don't just immediately turn your steering wheel all the way to the left. That's that's ridiculous. It's a good way to flip your car over and die. Like, the further you turn your wheel, the more you can feel yourself being pressed into your seat, and the closer you get to going, oh, my tires are about to slip, and you stop turning the wheel further left, right? And so there's a point where you stop before you go all the way. On a controller in your hand, you just go blink, and you move the stick all the way to the left immediately. And so there's
all
a disconnect.
All the way to the left.
All the way. Inside joke. No one will get that. There's a disconnect between, you know, what the situation that the game is actually trying to simulate and the experience that the player has. Let's hold this thought on our heads until the second half of our podcast today, because it'll come back around again. But, I think if we were able to communicate some of that experience, then actually the more realistic simulations would become more fun. But until that time, the arcadey sorts of simulations are simplifications of reality, and the game developers pretty ingeniously design these systems so that there's only enough complexity that it takes a small amount of time to master, and because that's what's gratifying in a game, is to master a particular system, make it so that you can't get it right 100% of the time, but if you work at it, you can get it right, you know, 85% of the time. And then you can use that to your advantage to accomplish the goals of the game. So, like a Mario Kart tries to do something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway,
so back to your game.
Yeah,
Underwater World.
All of that to say, the reason I bring up this game idea is because I discovered a game recently that comes closer than anything else, I think, to accomplishing this idea of the underwater ruined world. It's a game called Subnautica. Have you ever heard of it?
No, I don't think I have.
It's been around for a little while. Apparently, it was released in 2014 on PC Early Access.
10 years ago.
But then it had its main release in 2018, and then was only...
What? Release 4 years early? What sort of development cycles?
Don't get me started on Early Access stuff. It's a terrible practice that the industry has now, where developers will just kind of like... develop their game while they release it, and like that's stupid.
Terrible. That's like, can you imagine doing that with anything else ever? Read a book where you release, like, anyway.
Yeah, it's no, a terrible. No, it's a terrible idea. Movie
where you see like a incomplete scene and character development. Anyway.
Yeah, it's really
Subnautical.
Dumb. Subnautica. Subnautica.
Do you feel thrilled to be seeing sort of your vision, or do you feel a little like, oh, that was mine?
No, I feel mostly thrilled. I mean, if I seriously intended to implement the idea, then I might be a little bit bummed. But I'm glad to. I think this idea still has not been capitalized on fully, even after this. But this game, like I said, it was, I guess, ultimately released in 2018, and then they've released some like subsequent versions and a sequel as well. And so I just picked it up recently. I saw it a few years ago when it came out and thought, oh, that looks neat, and I just finally got around to picking it up. I love it. I'm having a great time with it. I played it a lot over the past week. The game itself is set in the future, so it's kind of a sci-fi setting, but the game begins with a big spaceship crashing on an alien planet far from, I guess, whatever future Earth is. And it's an ocean planet. And the player, your character, wakes up alone in a life pod floating in the middle of the ocean. And you can see the wreckage of the big capital ship, like, flaming off in the distance.
And we're talking a giant ship.
Yeah, like huge.
Hundreds
yeah, like,
of people live on kind of thing.
Right, or... right. In the Star Wars world, you know, think about the Star Destroyer, or maybe a little smaller than that, but a really large ship. Hundreds of people, yeah, maybe thousands. I can't remember what's in the game. Anyway, giant ship crashes, and you are on a floating life pod that you wake up on, and you have to essentially survive and find a way off planet. That's the goal of the game, is to survive and find a way off the planet. But it's an ocean planet, and so the entire gameplay of the game consists of you diving underwater, finding resources, avoiding scary alien underwater creatures, crafting tools that let you dive deeper and explore further, build like an underwater habitat, build like little vehicles to help you traverse, and then eventually make your way into the crashed ship to get, you know, plans and that sort of thing. Try to search for other survivors, and then eventually try to leave the planet.
What a refreshing like pitch. I really like the game. It sounds like it is designed to be a story mode and all of this. Like, I feel like games are less and less story mode and more like, how can I get people online and playing each other and selling them, you know, upgrades and stuff. So that sounds like fantastic.
Yeah, it is a little bit refreshing in that way. And I'll tell you what, the most refreshing thing is to me is that the game doesn't hold your hand in any way. Like, there's no tutorial, there's no narrative, really. It's not like the game opens up and says, you are Daniel Jenkins, officer blah, 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 on the USS Aurora. It doesn't open up with any of that. The game opens with you, like, waking up in the life pod, which is on fire.
How busy is the hood? Like, I imagine a minimalistic hood, meaning, like, hood. You don't see, like, I think that's the term for, like, you're seeing the life bar and your score.
Yeah, the heads-up display.
Heads-up display. What am I? Yeah, okay.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. No, you just pronounced it funny. It's fine. It's not too busy. I mean, one thing about the game that is interesting and may put some people off, including you maybe, is that you have to juggle a lot of different things at once. So another classic drawback of games that allow you to go underwater is managing your breath meter or your oxygen. You know, think about.
I do not like timed things where I'm going to die unless it's very acute. Like, I get it if you got to defuse a bomb as part of like part of the gameplay, and that's it's stressful. But if you're just like playing a game where you got to manage that meter, I don't know.
Think about Super Mario 64. Like, you know, the underwater levels.
I hated the water levels for that reason. Even though I was charmed by the mood and all that, it's just stressed me out. I avoided it. I tried to get the stars and get out of those levels.
So you would find this game, that aspect of this game, pretty annoying because you have an oxygen meter. And at the beginning of the game, you have no equipment. And so it's like 30 seconds or something. It's pretty short. Yeah. And you can't dive very far before you have to come back to the surface for oxygen. And then in addition to the oxygen system, you have health, which, you know, everyone who plays a video game is used to the health meter. So that probably doesn't bother you too much and makes sense for a game like this where you might get attacked by some creature. But then you also have food, hunger, and thirst that you have to manage too in the survival mode. So you have to catch fish and cook them and catch fish, and you can convert a particular type of fish into filtered water. And so that's an additional kind of management.
There's like four health meters in a way.
Right. And all of those are on the heads up display. So, you know, I could see some players finding that annoying. However, I'll tell you my experience with the game has been pretty positive. I find the hunger and thirst to be a little annoying, and they don't contribute too much, which I think is why they added an option to essentially not play with those turned on. But the oxygen is an important gameplay mechanic because it limits where in the world you can go. The game, you can dive as deep as like 1.5 kilometers under the water, you know, a long way down with the help of some vehicles that you can eventually craft. And so if you don't have enough oxygen capacity, then you can't go deep and you can't discover the new cool alien underwater environments. And so you can like get, you know, tanks to put on your back, and you can upgrade the tanks, and then you can get the vehicles. And while you're in the vehicle, you have, you can breathe normally. You don't have an oxygen meter, but your vehicles have power and health too. So you have to manage some resources. But the really cool thing about the game is just exploring all of the freaky alien underwater biomes, and there are a lot of enemies that are kind of scary and will pop out at you, and the lack of hand holding and the sense of danger does a really great job of creating an atmosphere that's very memorable. So I'm really enjoying the game a lot. I just wanted to mention it to you because I know we've talked about that underwater idea before. Although I will say the critique that you and I both predicted for this type of game, the controls, definitely applies here. They haven't nailed it. They didn't innovate on the controls.
Did they even try, or did they make it this sort of swampy, you know, dreamlike movement underwater? Like, what do you do if you were dreaming up a, like, do you just bypass it and lean into the arcadiness and say it's going to be swift and quick because you're going to, and you might even write in some story element about some, you know, device that allows you to manipulate water better. But the point is that you're trying to get to the point of moving easily underwater, or what? What do you do with it?
Well, I don't know what you do with it. That, you know, that's kind of the linchpin of the idea. But what this game, what Subnautica decided to do was essentially make it feel like a first-person shooter underwater. So you can move around pretty responsively when you're not in a vehicle underwater. And any direction that you're looking, if you press forward, then you'll swim in that direction. So, you know, swimming up and down, you just look up and down and you swim in that direction. And then you have two additional button controls, the L and R on the shoulders. And if you press, you know, the L button, then you rise in the water no matter which way you're looking. And if you press R, you sink in the water no matter which way you're looking.
Seems reasonable, like a pretty good thing to do.
Fine. It's reminiscent of helicopter controls in some other games. And so, you know, people who are familiar with first-person movement are going to be able to adapt relatively well. But I will say that, like, it's still not perfect. It's a little clunky. It's not a big-budget game, so it's not made by, you know, some huge studio or anything, I don't believe. And so it's got a little bit of bugginess to it, and you can get hung up on walls. You see people, you see like creatures just swim through walls and stuff sometimes.
Yeah.
And like the vehicle movement, pretty clunky and unpleasant, especially for one of them. So, you know, it's not a perfect game, but the atmosphere and the, you know, the idea of the game is pretty satisfying. So I've been having fun with it. I think I'm about to beat the game, actually.
What is this? What genre are we talking? Survivor horror? I'm imagining
it's not horror. It's a survival adventure, I guess I would say. It's not horror, although there are some kind of scary creatures, but it's not. That's not what the game is built for. But yeah, there's a lot of resource gathering, so you have to like grab, you know, materials from the bottom of the ocean and craft stuff to, you know, to craft your vehicles and that kind of thing.
I probably don't have an accurate take on this, but does this revive some of your faith in gaming? And in that, like, I feel like you have you're a Nintendo fan and you kind of know what's out there and you hear about games and you hear they're pretty good and you don't play them often. If they're just some, like a game like this, you might pick up, but you have a backlog of enough, you know, substantive like Nintendo stuff. And so does this make you go, oh yeah, this is kind of like great that there's some indie game out there that actually is fantastic, even if there are problems with it? I don't know. Like, does that renew some sense of hope, or do you are okay?
No, it doesn't. And the reason is because, you know, this game, well, it started its journey in 2014, and since 2014, gaming has become pretty bleak. And I don't think that it would be easy for this type of game, a new version of this type of game, to become as popular today. And to be even more of a doomer, this game in particular, Subnautica, has a sequel that's set in like a frozen biome, which sounds like something I would really enjoy, but apparently,
yeah, exactly.
apparently they took a lot of steps back and introduced annoying things into the game. I haven't played it, so I can't speak to that personally. I may or may not actually play that sequel, but I've heard that it's worse than the first entry, which wouldn't surprise me because everything has gotten worse in the last 10 years, really, entertainment-wise. and so, yeah, I think I don't have much hope for that sort of thing. Now, if, you know, if Nintendo or some other, you know, remaining decent company picks up on an idea like this and implements it, then wonderful. But yeah, I don't have too much hope for that. But it is nice to discover, you know, a game like this that I, you know, that I missed when it was fresh and can check it out.
Well, like B-movies, we have, it feels like we just have so many that we'll there's still discovery mode that we feel is fresh. We've not scraped the bottom of the barrel, but like it doesn't feel quite the same about video games. There's not just this unending.
There's not as many. There are lots of video games nowadays, but it's not the same as with movies.
Plus you're looking for quality too. And B-movies were specifically not looking for quality.
Yeah, and I guess another difference is, I hope I'm not misspeaking here, but it takes some technical ability to make a video game. It doesn't really take that much technical ability to make a movie, a bad movie. Yeah, it still takes some technical ability to make a bad video game. yeah. But to make a bad movie, you just have to pick up a camera and like point at places. I'm being pretty reductionist, but I mean, you and I have seen B movies where that's exactly what it like feels that. Like happens. Yes. So,
oh man, yeah, you're totally right. We have, I mean, the idea of narrative form is just barely there.
Right. All right. Well, anyway, I just wanted to talk about that a little bit, but I do have another topic that I wanted to discuss with you, and it kind of ties in a little bit in one way that's a little surprising. So have you heard of Neuralink?
I am vaguely familiar with Neuralink.
It's been in the news recently because the first...
witchcraft, I tell you. Witchcraft.
Yeah, right. The first human patient of Neuralink has had a little bit of exposure. I've got an excerpt from an article that I want to read to you, and then we can kind of talk about it.
Okay.
All right, so here's the article. It's from Fortune, fortune.com. The first patient of Elon Musk's Neuralink has been presented to the public. Nolan Arbaugh had all but given up playing Civilization VI ever since a diving accident dislocated two vertebrae in his cervical spinal cord, leaving him paralyzed from the shoulders down. When confined to his wheelchair, the 29-year-old American is totally dependent on the care of his parents, who need to shift his weight every few hours to avoid pressure sores from sitting too long in the same position. Moving a cursor on a display, furthermore, required the use of a mouth stick, a specialized assistive device used by quadriplegics. After becoming the first human to undergo a brain chip implant by Musk's Neuralink, however, he claims to have gained the ability to control a computer with his mind. The first thing Arbaugh then says he did was stay up all night until 6 a.m. playing Sid Meier's epic strategy game. Quote, "Now I can literally just lie in bed and play to my heart's content. Honestly, the biggest restriction at this point was having to wait for the implant to charge once I used all of it," end quote, he said in a video testimonial Neuralink uploaded to its official channel on X on Wednesday. And then Elon Musk also had a post, "Long-term, it is possible to shunt the signals from the brain motor cortex past the damaged part of the spine to enable people to walk again and use their arms normally. If true, that marks a major advancement for Musk's company." And that's the excerpt from the article that I've got.
Whoa. I mean, that sounds so sci-fi like. So not only can it, if it can read your brain, then it can connect. If you're a paraplegic or quadriplegic, it can read those signals and then communicate them to your leg or arms or whatever's not working. That's what he's saying long term.
That's what he's saying. Yeah, you could bypass the damaged area and potentially communicate again to your limb or, you know, distal nervous system.
It's weird that made me think. I mean, I'm sure you have some questions lined up and all that, but like this whole like brain reading tech, and then I never thought of my body as brain reading tech. But that, yeah, the but way it's framed at the end, it is brain reading tech. Like or my brain is dominating my body. But I don't know. I don't know which is which. Is my brain telling it to do it, or is it understanding what's being asked of it and doing it?
Yeah, well, think about. I find it interesting to think about the path that a signal takes from, you know, inception, from your thought or wherever thoughts come from. But that's a whole other,
it's in the philosophical realm. But can we say it's in the brain though?
Yeah, sure. Like, I mean, the path that thought takes from your brain to the Xbox when you press the, you know, you want to accelerate your Project Gotham car. Like where does that go? So it comes from your brain. You have some neurons that fire an electrical signal in your brain. That signal passes through your nerves down to, you know, your fingers or whatever, and then your muscles respond and you press a button on your controller. The controller receives that signal. An electrical signal goes through the wire of your controller or through radio waves in the air, depending on what kind of controller you're using, to your Xbox, which then receives the signal, processes it, and, you know, and then it's all in the electronics.
I think of all the examples, you went with like a Project Gotham Xbox racing example.
Because we talked about it earlier.
Yeah, I know. It's just so funny. yeah. No, but you're right. And it's weird. I feel a little silly even, but like, you know, when you tell your hand to press the button, like even that language telling your hand or your brain communicates to your hand and then your hand like says, your hand does it. But when I say your hand does it, it executes the action, is there some form of acknowledgement? Is it thinking and saying, okay, you know? And when you're a paraplegic, it's like the signal's lost, even though your hand might be there ready to take on signals, and you're just like, getting no signals, so I'm not going to do anything. But even though I am capable, so yes. I need something to think for me. But I'm limited in my language, I guess, but I'm saying it feels like there's a conversation between the brain and then the actions of the body. And when I say conversation, that just has this like two-way street, as if it's thinking back and going, I'll allow it, or, oh, I have limitations and I can't, or I won't, or something. I don't know. Which is, I think, wrong.
Yeah, probably, I think that's wrong.
Scientifically. But yeah, it's interesting.
It is interesting. I don't think it's right, but it is interesting. Your hand isn't, you know, I mean, I guess in a manner of speaking, it's waiting for signals, but it's not like, you know, off doing its own thing.
Waiting is a metaphor. It's like, yeah, yeah, it's not, right. It's not actually like, waiting.
It, in the same way that a ball isn't just waiting for you to kick it, you know, like it takes your action in order to evoke some reaction.
So our sense of being really is, we're, at least for this conversation, is wholly in the brain. Like the sense of soul and all of this is there, because the rest is just this execution machine. The body is this execution machine.
Yeah, for the purposes of this conversation, I guess I would say so. I mean, I guess there's a question that we don't have to get into, which is like, how much does your embodied state influence your internal sense of self, right? Like we've developed as walking beings who grab things and speak words, and that influences our sense of self. Whereas if, you know, on Baby Island, you were to sever the spinal cord of a baby, you know, right after it was born and it never was able to use its arms or legs, the self that develops might be different. It was less of a...
I would almost say certainly, yeah.
Yeah, right. Or if you could grow a brain in a tank, you know, and have a human being. Or this is the premise of lots of, like, sci-fi movies where you have AI who, you know, attains sentience and they have no bodies. How does that affect their being? So,
and a slightly different thought, and I know we, like, don't need to go down these thought experiments all the time, but you have that hammer, maybe a family hammer, and then you accidentally break the handle and you replace it, and then 15 years later the head gets dented beyond repair and you replace it, and now it's no longer like I'm imagining, like, well, when, like, is it the hammer, is it the family hammer anymore? Like, I don't
know. The same idea, they say, and I think this is not correct, but they say that after 7 years every cell in your body has essentially been, you know, replaced, and so are you really the same person that you were seven years ago?
You said you can't remember things for about 7 years as a fresh slate.
Well, it makes sense. It does make sense.
Your lived experience, I know you love that phrase, is
I've been saying that.
Testament to this.
I've been saying that for, I don't know, 7 years? That's the earliest I can remember. That's the earliest I can remember saying it.
Oh man. Okay, let's get back to the idea of
the Neuralink
technology that we had. What's it called again?
Neuralink.
Okay, Neuralink. It can read your thoughts, essentially.
Well, so all right, here's how it works.
Read intentions?
It's a coin-sized little implant, and it's actually implanted underneath your skull. So it's a pretty.
Do you resist that immediately? Tech implanted inside you to like, okay, why?
I think most people do.
It's just so invasive, and it's like every dystopian thing we've ever read warns us of this moment, and here we are.
Yeah, right. So it's about the size of a coin. It didn't say what size coin, but I assume it's like a nickel or something.
That's obnoxious.
Yeah.
Why do you assume a nickel? Anyway.
Because it's kind of one of the middle-sized coins.
Okay.
Yeah. So I can't be that wrong.
Yeah.
they don't publish a lot of information on the device, at least that I could find. And apparently, their Neuralink, the company, is perceived as being somewhat secretive at this point.
Oh man! But not a good anyway, look for a brain scanning reading technology company. Yeah, we're not telling you what we do.
This little device is implanted under your skull, and then it has these threads that kind of reach down into the brain. There's 64 of them.
Threads? That sounds terrifying. I don't know why. Like spider-like tentacles, you know?
I mean, you can imagine these neural, you know, your neurons are very, very tiny. They're cells in your brain. And you have to be able to read the signals that your neurons are firing at a very fine level of detail. And so these are tiny, microscopic. I don't know if the threads are microscopic, but they're so small and delicate that a robot has to perform the surgery to implant this thing.
Yeah.
The battery is charged by inductive charging, so you know you don't have to like dig into your brain to replace the battery, which is convenient. And kind of how it works.
A MagSafe kind of thing, you know, zoom, put your head against the thing.
Something like that. And then sensors use those threads to detect when particular neurons in your motor cortex fire, and they receive that signal, and then the device transmits it, you know, to wherever.
So it maps your brain thinking. It asks you, think left, think left, think left. You keep bombarding it, and so it maps out this must, when these brain signals look this way, it means he's thinking left.
Yes.
And then does right, then up and down, and then whatever series of commands you might want to execute, and then
right.
I can like acknowledge when those, when you're thinking those commands.
Yes. So I imagine there's some amount of training that has to be done. You know, when they implant this thing, they have to have a pretty good understanding of the person's brain that they connected to, and they have to train that person to imagine moving their arm up, down, left, right, and then figure out what kinds of signals they're going to be reading when the person thinks in this way, and then map those signals to some behavior in the device, the device that the Neuralink is connecting to. That's how I imagine it works. Now, apparently, the device isn't just from brain to device, meaning it reads your brain signals and then sends those signals elsewhere to be responded to. Apparently, it can also apply stimulation to the neurons. Now, I didn't see any...
What? So it goes the other way? Holy moly.
But I didn't see any mention of that actually being done, so I don't know if that is a proposed future thing or if that... I don't know the status of that. This one instance of this guy playing, you know, his computer with Neuralink, this was not mentioned in this instance whatsoever.
So, like, but in theory, if they're testing it, they go, "What are we telling you right now?" And he could go, "Left, you're telling me left." Yep, sure enough.
Yes.
Like, the idea is,
yeah,
or even make him want, like, just have this like subconscious or conscious itch of going left. I don't know, or literally irresistible urge, whatever that might be. Oh,
yeah,
well, I do not like. That's so. That's the
well, right. That opens up a lot of questions. There now, there's only 64 threads, and they're connected to your motor cortex. So, you know, obviously, where you connect these threads is gonna determine what kind of signals you can read, how you control the device, and down the line, how the device will. I don't want to say control you, but like how it will influence. Your brain, particularly. But so, like, all right, putting aside the potential dystopian effects, let's look at the, for now, because I like to talk about those. They're very interesting.
Yeah.
For now, let's talk about, I guess, the near term, which is what Neuralink is really focusing on, which is helping, you know, people who've been disabled by, you know, an injury or a defect of some kind, like this guy. Who's a quadriplegic, helping him be able to interact with the world more easily.
About my brother's disability and be able to say hunt food I guess you're talking about the other stuff to motor cortex stuff, but like if you could just get it to like some basic language for nonverbal people, you know,
yeah,
that could be great.
Right, anything. They have plans to try to address all kinds of things, vision, vision and auditory problems, even fatigue and memory issues. I don't know how
wow.
they planned that, but it was mentioned in a blurb.
Because don't we all have memory issues? However you want to define it, we're not. Our memory is so imperfect.
Mm-hmm.
Like even someone with a strong memory, memory champions are pretty bad. You know,
right?
So yeah, wow. Can you imagine? Oh man.
But just in terms of dealing with, you know, people with paralysis of some kind, it seems pretty amazing. You know, there have been things attempted in the past to read, you know, your brain signals from outside of the skull, and you know, people have had limited success with that. Not no success, but limited success, just because it's very difficult to get an accurate reading from outside the skull.
I'm thinking about the Apple Vision Pro stuff, just tracking vision, and then it sounded like he had some sort of tongue device, which makes I can conjure up some vague image of them, someone in a wheelchair leaning over and manipulating things with their tongue. So that's all fantastic, and I mean, in conjunction, if you start to get the Apple Vision Pro, whatever, working with something, some Neuralink thing, and like really giving them some virtual confidence. If he's able to play this epic game that I'm assuming is complicated and requires a lot of movement and clicking and, you know, not just strategy, because strategy, it's, I mean, his brain, this isn't a commentary on how smart he is. Let's just assume he's of average, within that average range, but he's able to manipulate a complex game. Then I'm assuming he's like communicating to a mouse or a controller of some sort. And like, yeah.
Yeah. I would imagine that you don't have the resolution to do it with 64 connections. You don't have the resolution to do anything too complex yet, but moving a two-dimensional mouse pointer and saying click here, you know, even left click, right click, you know, that doesn't take too much.
I mean, just the invitation to privacy that he can now have instead of having to play with someone else, like someone else click for him, or if he wants to play, he has to be conscious of their time and the fact that like it's their like. Like, if it's his parents or a friend, like, I don't know. Like, you have to be conscious of their wants and needs and desires and all of that. But now he, like, has some freedom. And I imagine that's the greatest gift that all this is given. It's less about playing some game he likes and, like, but yet having some degree of autonomy and decision-making without consulting others. Like, oh, my gosh. Like, the quality of life increase that makes, that alone is just, I mean, significant.
Think about it from the experience perspective. Like, if he can move a mouse and click the buttons, or potentially in the future even press keyboard, you know, letters or whatever, then his virtual experience will be, you know, marginally different from yours or my virtual experience. And so that means that for some segment of this guy's life, he actually won't experience being disabled, you know, if he can naturally and easily interact with a computer in that way. And so, yeah, it's got to be like salvaging a major portion of your life to be able to have that one area where you can kind of forget about your life situation for a little while.
All my resistance toward social media or digital worlds, I should say, like complex digital worlds, like I have real concerns about people going, like putting themselves online. But for someone like him, I have no resistance. I would even encourage, why would he not want to escape to that world where he can still have moments of autonomy and, you know, exercise his will and still do lots of great things and socialize and all. Like, I really feel like I don't, all my resistance toward those things fades away quickly with someone like him.
Well, think about this too. This goes one step further. If you can use your brain signals to control a mouse and a couple of buttons, then, I mean, a mouse and a couple of buttons are mechanical devices that live outside of your body, and those mechanical devices are transmitting electrical signals to a computer. But there's no reason why he couldn't use those same signals to control, you know, an automated wheelchair or, you know, a mechanical arm or whatever. And I think that's part of the future that this company is envisioning, is that they can interface these devices with, you know, robotic limbs or whatever, so that people can truly have some amount of freedom and autonomy in the real world, not just in digital spaces.
Like, you wonder if this is the great hack, like this is the moment, the Neuralink, you know, as people talk about like, oh, the internet and then, you know, AI or something, but like this seems so significant. This seems in some ways like more significant than AI and all that. Well, I don't know. I don't know how to even, they're different, I guess.
I mean, it's
profound. They're profound.
If it stays in the realm of assistance for the disabled, then it's not the next hack, right? It's just a really, really great thing for those people, you know, like the wheelchair was whenever whoever invented the wheelchair, glasses or what, you know, whatever assistive devices.
I think I said hack. I meant just like overcoming one of the great obstacles we face.
Yeah, I know what you meant for that. But like, if it stays in that realm, I just don't think that population of people is large enough for it to really be a huge culturally influencing thing. However, if it moves from the realm of, you know, an assistance device to a regular consumer product like the iPhone was, or even VR, which, you know, I don't think is fully caught on yet, but people are certainly aware of it. Like, if it comes to the point where 10% of people have a Neuralink or similar device, then yes, this becomes a gigantic culturally influential development.
Yes, and that's when things go awry. I mean, I'm trying to think about advertisements, and well, I don't. I always go straight to the dystopian stuff, so I'll withhold until you give me permission.
Well, that's what I was going to ask next. Is what do you think the future is for tech like this? Where do you see this going in 10 years, 20 years, and then like 50 years or something?
Yeah, I mean, it could be like text-to-speech and sort of clunky, and it works. Let's paint the path toward consumer products. Like, it becomes somewhat available to those that are like disabled, but it becomes so easy to apply to everyone and affordable or whatever that it becomes a neat experiment, like a high-end tech product, in which I'm trying to think of like some high-end tech users want to be hyper productive, and they want to be able to have a screen dedicated to their like thought. I don't know. I don't know exactly, but some sort of like hyper internet users or hyper productive people that also are like affluent and want to, I don't know, just see what they can do with it. They come up with some pretty inventive uses that I probably won't come up with on the spot. But that it's extending their production for their job in some way. They're coding faster. They're just manipulating the interface. We've always kind of complained that we still use a mouse and click on windows, and yeah, we still have icons. Like it seems to open up like an exploration that, all right, finally we can do this in a more, and this could lead to fixing those issues. And then it becomes, that's the like 10-year thing, or maybe even 20-year thing. And then it starts to, once we're all plugged in, and once advertisers like get a hold, or policymakers, and my mind goes to Thought Police and Minority Report type stuff. Yeah. You know, you have wrong thoughts and you're getting fined and stuff. I just had to say it. I was like itching to say that. I needed to say like, oh my gosh, they're going to be like, you thought something racist or thought something, insert the phobic or whatever. And, really what's weird is we've always said you can't police thought, or you shouldn't police thought because you can't, like you just can't know someone's thoughts. Does that change? Like, if you can police someone's thoughts, because if you can accurately, if someone's like, I'm going to bomb this, you know, this institution or shoot up this school or whatever, and you can knowingly say, oh, they mean it, and they're not just, and this is a sophisticated technology that can delineate between I'm pissed and I'm thinking I'm going to kill that person versus like, no, I have intent and I am planning and mapping this out. If you can read those thoughts, is there some moral imperative to interfere? And then you're in this weird world where like, oh my God, I do want people to shut down violence if possible before it happens, I guess. I guess in theory that doesn't seem so disagreeable, but oh my gosh, I hate where I'm at already.
So yeah, I think, well, certainly anyone can imagine that dystopian kind of future. I think we're a long way from that sort of thing.
Yes.
I think there's a huge barrier. People, whenever I read about people talking about Neuralink, everyone always talks about the ads and the thought police, but there's a huge barrier in front of both of those things. And that is, we don't understand thoughts. Like, we don't get it. We don't know the language in which thoughts are encoded in our brain. Same thing for memories. You could have a surgeon, the best neurosurgeon in the world, even if you could keep a patient alive during some, you know, ridiculous open brain surgery, you wouldn't be able to pull out and identify the location in the brain where, you know, their telephone number is stored or something. Like, we can't do that. We don't know how to read that data. Somehow, mysteriously, it works in our brain, but we don't understand it. We might be able to generally localize the areas that have some effect on memory And we've inferred that from people who've had brain damage in those areas and have consequently lost some of their memory.
Mm.
So it would be really difficult for a device, even if instead of 64 threads, it had 6,400 threads or 64,000 threads, it would be really difficult to build a device that could understand the signals going on, right? And interpret what's in your brain.
Okay.
And convert that to, oh, he's thinking about the gaze or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? I totally buy that. You'll never, like, it seems so impossible to get granular enough to say, oh, she doesn't like my dress because, and she's, you know, you're reading her thoughts essentially.
Yeah.
But it seems to me that you could start easily start going horny, hungry,
yes,
rage,
right,
you know, these sorts of things on this big level.
Potentially what you could do is detect those primitive kind of very very broad, well,
primal, very, I should say.
Yeah, very broad emotional states and then reacting in a certain way.
But it'd be weird because there'd be some crossover between, I bet, love and hate or like excitement, like both like positive and negative might have so much crossover. I don't know, maybe not.
Here's another possible route into dystopia is, you know, they've hooked into the motor cortex. Okay, that's great. You can detect how people are intending to move their limbs or whatever. But if they can hook into the visual or speech areas of the brain and they can determine what you're looking at or what you're vocalizing, then, you know, then it becomes, because people, when they learn to speak, they think in words, they think in language, oftentimes, right? And so
I think yes,
not always, but many people think in words. And so if they can hook into that part of the brain and be able to get some sense of what someone is vocalizing, whether internally or externally, then they may be able to gather some information about what someone is thinking. Maybe that's a possible route. And again, I don't even put that in the 50-year. I think that's a long way off before it gets to that point. But
right.
I think in the near term, like in the 10-year time frame, like
almost nothing happens. But
almost nothing happens. Like they just opened human clinical trials for Neuralink, like this month or last month. So you can sign up if you want to be one of the first people in a human clinical trial for this. But like, I think it's basically restricted to its current form for between 5 and 10 years, you know, while it's going through trials and it's helping people overcome some kinds of paralysis and stuff. I think the first major hurdle is the invasiveness of the surgery. Like even some hyperproductive businessman who wants to, you know, check his emails without pulling out his phone or whatever, is not going to go under like the
brain
knife.
Brain surgery.
To get something implanted in his skull. So it's going to require either a technological development so that this can be something subcutaneous or externally worn, or it's going to require a surgical technological advancement, which you can do in a, you know, outpatient procedure, and they can just go sprink and spike something into your head and...
Yeah, like a shot, one of these, you know, futuristic shots that's really going under the skin and like,
something like that.
Picturing
nanobots,
you know, some sort of pssss, like,
yeah,
noise,
right,
you know,
yes, like, it's definitely gotta have a noise like that.
Yeah.
And all right, so that's barrier number one. Probably simultaneously they'll work on the resolution of what they can read in the brain. So instead of 64 connections, that'll grow and they'll connect to other more fine-tuned areas, so they could detect whether you're intending to move your right index finger or, you know, your left foot or whatever. And when they get to the point where they can detect pretty much any of your large body movements, that'll be pretty revolutionary, I think.
Absolutely. But let's say, what's the next step after motor cortex? Okay, you've done that, and
it's got to be
great. Where do you go?
It's got to be vision and voice, right? It's they're going to do the other things that people are, you know, have disabilities and struggle with. So it's going to be auditory, visual, and vocal.
Yeah.
And that would be amazing. And I think is maybe achievable. You know, that might be in the 20-year time frame sort of thing. But I mean,
that's exciting.
Neuralink themselves, they say that they want to tackle memory and fatigue and attention. So, like, let's imagine for a second the utopian vision. If everything goes right and it's not abused, like, it could be amazing, right? Like, we could be able to, you know, have a painless surgery, or it's not even a surgery. It's just a thing that we slap on our heads, or some micro device that we get when we're born or something. You know, I don't know what it is, but it's just some technological platform that we have on or with us. And you can, like, we no longer have to interface with machines with our hands. We don't have light switches. We just walk in and think, you know, that we want the lights on, and it's an extension of our, like, kinesthetic sense, you know, our sense of our body in space. We can control devices without having to interact with them directly.
The idea of fatigue sounds, I can, like, wrap my head around it. Like, I'm less tired. I don't know if I even understand memory. Like in terms of memory, what's memory's relationship with focus and attention?
Well, because, I mean, certainly there is a relation. The way I imagine this working is, like, some sort of new version of mnemonic devices. This thing in your head would, if you're struggling to remember something, it would serve up cues in some fashion that would let you, oh yeah, it was that.
Oh, I was envisioning, like, if I really want to remember this movie, I should put it on and go do it. You're saying, afterward, I can't remember what happened a couple of years ago, and I put it on, and, like, it actually is helping me retrieve memories. I thought it was only going to be useful, like, okay, this, you will have a better recall if you use it. Go and have active experiences while using this.
Well, you see what I'm saying? I mean, I think you would have to have this in your head for it to, you know, like, it would, while, I don't know how it would work, so I don't know the mechanism or...
No, I'm just saying, it's like, if it's my wedding day, and I'm really, it's my wedding day, and it's really want to remember this in the future, so I'm going to have this device on and active while I'm going through my wedding day.
Yeah, that's how I think it would work.
And then, you know, using it again to retrieve, that's the optimum way. But if the device comes out in 20 years, will it help me retrieve my wedding day memories now that,
probably
that I did
not
have the device for?
I imagine not. Like, like, again, we don't know how memories are stored in the brain. And so, like, there's just some natural decay there. And so I think those pieces are missing forever, or...
Well, we just start to learn, though. Like, intelligence starts to, like, as we get better tools like this, we just learn some people just don't have as much. Like, it can't invent more memory for you or more capacity. It just helps you utilize the hardware you've been given, your brain, better. And so you just come up against the limits more explicitly as we have tools that help you access your brain. So you're just and so it's like, yep, you just have limited capacity. Like, that's okay. Like, or I don't know.
Well, think about how, you know, only some people can get forklift certified or backhoe certified or certified to fly a plane. Like, these are complex tasks that require complex manipulation of devices. And you might have to get Neuralink certified, you know, like, you may not be coordinated enough in your own in your brain to interact. Like, if this guy who has the first Neuralink and he's playing Civilization with his, you know, telepathic mouse, like, if he's not able to envision moving his arm up, down, left, right, or whatever the very coarse resolution of this thing is, he's not going to be able to utilize the device to its full potential. And if we do get to the point where we can map, imagine that we had a thread for every muscle under our voluntary control in our body, however many hundreds of those there are. Like, there are people right now, perfectly able, healthy people who do not have good motor control over all of those muscles in their body, right? And so if you can't do it in your body, Neuralink isn't going to be able to help you very much. And although, now that I say that, maybe in our utopian vision of the world, if it can apply stimulus to the brain, maybe the Neuralink, maybe it's like the Matrix where you can actually download dancing programs or whatever.
Why not?
Right?
This is,
why not?
But like, we're having this conversation not in just complete thought experiment land. We're talking about, if it is truly attached to some motor, you know, like these functions, and you can map out, you're just saying people have to get forklift certified. And it's a very just mechanical knowing it. Like, yeah. Why couldn't I? And you're saying that Neuralink can communicate to the brain. I could upload how to do a forklift in my brain, at least while it's connected and stuff. I mean, far-fetched theory, but I guess it's like not as ridiculous as
I mean,
as
how to do Matrix, a for- you know? How to do a forklift, maybe, but like how to play a particular piano piece.
Sure.
Right.
I don't think like, that's. Yeah.
Like, if you are sitting in the right location and you start your hands on the right keys
and it's shocking me in such a way that my fingers are moving.
Right, the device knows the dimensions of your fingers and such. You could press play or think play or whatever, and the thing would take over and send appropriate signals to your brain to move your hands. Yeah. I mean... Yeah.
But there's no, like, struggle or learning in there. But I do... But, like, it seems fundamentally different. Okay, you have that where you can press play and do some fairly complex things like play piano or do the forklift. What I want to know, though, is if, okay, the forklift operation, it can make me do some specific set of functions, but I want to know if I cannot know what a forklift, how to operate a forklift, I upload it, and then I go and I think, I'm actually actively going, I want to lift this thing and put it on this shelf up here, and then I can do it.
Well, I mean... If you
outsource, that's the interesting thing, right? That's much different than like I'm going into autopilot mode and it's happening through my body, which is eerie and I don't like that. But I do like the idea of going, I want to accomplish this, and all of a sudden I'm an expert.
You could imagine some marriage of the Neuralink, which is the interface device, and some sort of AI, which, you know, actually does some sort of goal-driven computation. So if you can translate from your internal brain, I want to lift this box and put it on that shelf, if you can translate that into communicable speech or some other signal, pass it through the Neuralink interface to some AI device, which then parses out that desire, figures out the steps required to lift the box and put it on the shelf, translate that into motor signals, send that back to the Neuralink, and then the Neuralink stimulates your brain in the particular order to accomplish the task, you would still be a third-person observer of this task going on, but it would be the task that you devised being carried out with your body.
Similarly, if I'm like playing a guitar live, like I'm riffing and I'm thinking... Because I can, like, in my head jam out, but I don't know how to play guitar. So, it would – what you're describing would be similar, right? Is that analogous? That, like, I would actually be playing the notes and thinking them, but something weird is happening where my body is doing it. I am thinking it, but there's a disconnect. Like, what I'm doing is different than what the artist who knows how to play guitar and do those things. Mm-hmm. Like, and why is it different? I'm thinking it, my body's doing it, and I'm creatively expressing the notes inside my brain. Like, and it's happening, but yet I'm not the artist who, like, I don't know, I'm not the artist who's struggled and learned and has this rote memory and, you know, rote, like, muscle memory, and I don't know. It just feels fundamentally different, but I don't know if it is.
I mean, the situation that you describe of internally visualizing, or I don't know what the verb form of audialize. I don't know the word, but you know what I'm saying. Like, picturing the music in your head. I do that too, and actually, I've always found it very frustrating that I can't take that music that I can hear in my head and. Put and play it physically. I'm not talented enough.
You try to tell someone about it. It sounds so stupid. It's like so good, right? Like, no,
I mean,
it isn't.
You can't vocalize it to the same degree. And like, I don't know if you've ever had this experience, but like, I can hear like orchestral pieces. Like, I can hear the different instruments in my head of and how I want them to go. And I would never be able to replicate that on one instrument right in front of me. And I'm not talented enough with musical software to like, or keyboard or anything like that to get it out of my brain and onto paper or into, you know, a physical device.
You might not even know what instrument is making that sound, but you know you want to hear it.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And so, like, if I could have this, you know, device read and understand the melodies and the harmonies and all of that stuff going on in my brain, would I not be an artist? Like, is it any different from a person, instead of using a real drum set, using a digital drum set, or playing the drums on their keyboard? You know, like, they have the music in their head, and they're using these clunky devices that we've built, whether electronic devices like a keyboard and mouse or a synth board, or the arguably even more clunky devices, literally clunky like a drum set where you just clunk on them, to produce music, right? So it's just a matter of interfacing with the world in some way. So I don't know.
Think you might be right, but I also suspect that, like, someone having to put in those hours of just drills just to master basic muscle memory movements, it's the relationship with the device, and then out of that creativity is intertwined with that struggle versus,
that's right. There's a distinction, right? A great guitarist doesn't just know melody. Like, he doesn't simply know which notes to play in which order. He has a technique that he bends the string in a certain way, and he has a certain vibrato when he plays a note. And, you know, the same can be said for drummers. They mute the cymbals at the certain point, or they play with a certain attack on the drums. And, you know, all the instruments, I'm sure, have their intricacies in that way. And so it's not simply playing, you know, A, G, E, F in that order with perfect timing. It's how you play those notes as well. So there is something to the embodiment of the musical action.
And that relationship with the instrument or tool, I guess, if you're another artist, like, you know, with a paintbrush or something, like, it's like that those tools are extensions of the self, and that relation, it really, I don't mean that in a hippie way. I mean that it's like you're using this tool to express yourself, and it's become like almost there's a oneness there that I wonder what is lost. It's like, because like what you said is so fascinating. If you could get the music in your brain out, I want to hear that. I think collectively we would be better, because there's some brilliant minds that did not put in the work or didn't have the access or whatever.
You've heard my rap lyrics and everything. Imagine if I could get that out.
It would be beautiful and good for all of us. Like, we would be elevated. However, like, I think it just makes it, I don't know if it's just because I have reverence for those who really did put in the struggle, and I want to honor that struggle so deeply, and that I'm holding on too tightly to this idea of you need to develop a relationship with that tool, because what we're saying is this Neuralink is the tool, and if you master it, all other tools be damned. There's now just one tool.
I mean, the creators of Neuralink, I don't think would want you to think of it as a tool. I think they would want you to think of it as invisible as possible. You know, it's a different method to get your thoughts out of your brain.
I mean, I'm just jumping to the, I don't have to master tools anymore.
Sure.
I can be a master of all tools. So,
well, think about this. Do you think composers are not masters of any tools and therefore deserve less musical respect than, you know, a performer?
No, I think they probably have to go study like music theory or understand and get all of that down. Like they have to put in that same struggle. It's just in a different way.
Well, I mean, would not a composer be just as or more effective if they could? I mean, that's what they learn, the music theory. Yeah, sure. But a person with Neuralink could do the same. And instead of having to use their hand to write it down on a piece of paper or a computer keyboard to type it, they could just think the music out of their head. Like, wouldn't that be better for composers? And would that make them less of an artist?
I don't think it would.
Yeah, I don't either. I see that being a huge improvement for musical development. If you could truly do that, if you could detect both the melody and the timbre of the stuff that people are thinking in their heads.
Well, what does this do to singing? If I've been told I have a pretty decent speaking voice. I cannot sing because holding the notes, but in this world where like I'm now exercising my like everything correctly in the way, I mean, I could sing and perhaps very well. And do I deserve that is that a talent, singing? Like, yes, it is. Of course it is. But, and now more people can sing beautifully and use their voice. Does it level the playing field with singing?
Is it, is it a bad thing for people to, if more people could make beautiful art or sing beautiful songs or produce creative works, is that a worse thing for the world? Like, are you contending that unearned achievement, that there might be some, like, this is some bad outcome?
I am saying that. Yeah. Okay. I am saying that, like, AI art is a real problem because of the I think part of the art is the journey to the production and the story behind it, and just being able to quickly type in a prompt and click print or something is not the same as someone, you know, having taking their experiences and really laboring away at producing a piece that's original and beautiful and an expression of the self. So yeah, I do. And I worry that, like, all of a sudden I can do these, like, I can do my manipulate my voice and record something, and like, and it might actually be very good. So like I might have something meaningful from my, you know, teaching background to say, and I can utilize my voice and play an instrument and hit and have a hit single, but it's gonna be a very crowded market in the music field in this scenario. But like, I don't know that I deserve that, and that's who am I to say deserve, but like, man, my concern is all these people who, like, poor musicians and artists, they're all just, you know,
I don't have the same concern, at least not to the same degree that you do. Even with AI art, like, if I want to see, if you show me some art and it looks really cool, then I'm satisfied. I don't care if it was made by a computer or a person who struggled through art school or whatever. Like, I'm interested in the end product of the art. Now, I mean, that's me as an art consumer. I can understand as an art producer feeling like there's some wind that's been taken out of your sails. But, like, I mean, when they invented the printing press, did all the calligraphists, you know, collectively become depressed because now their, you know, their services aren't needed as much and people can just type? Yeah. And was something of value really lost there?
That's the, because all the taxi people were upset when Uber came about, but they were just like, sorry, buddies. Like, it's just, you've been outdated. Like, this is better kind of thing.
Right. Like, I don't know. I'm not just worried about that. And I also, like, if the path that we're talking about where you could think music and then, you know, this device could, you know, understand it and put it on paper or into sound that could be shared, to me, that just eliminates barriers, these clunky physical barriers that are inefficient. And does that mean that the people who have learned to overcome those barriers are now less able in some way? No, I don't think so. It means that we, the consumers of music, are now blessed to be able to have so much more potentially amazing music. It's kind of like the same idea of teaching people literacy, right? Teaching people to read or write. Like, it's not a bad thing that more people know how to read or write, because that's more brains that can produce more useful things. Can they also produce more trash and fill up the internet with trash? Yeah, sure, they can. But, you know, they can produce wonderful things too.
I wonder if there's a positive spin here. When I think about actors and acting, like, the same actors appear in Hollywood because we want them to. We want our idols to worship. We want our pop stars to keep producing songs, although there's inevitably other artists that are just as good, and plenty of actors that are, truly are both as, you know, good-looking and as talented as our A-list actors. But we want the familiarity. Like, we want to see them on screen and go, ah, I love Chris Pratt, he's hilarious, or whatever it is. Like, and that's why movie makers are willing to pay them a lot of money, because, like, that name recognition. Like, we want idols in our culture. And so if you water down the, like, I'm just trying to do a positive spin where now our pop artists aren't, it either dilutes to, like, we don't have singular, we're all rallying around singular artists, but I think we still would. It just, maybe it wouldn't be like pop singy artists, or maybe it still would be and not change a thing. I don't know. But do you see what I'm saying? Did I say that? with any clarity.
I'm not sure I totally follow. I mean, you're suggesting that because there would be so many people able to produce music that we wouldn't settle on one person. We would pick.
That would be the idea that like we would have transitioned from the Beatles, but like the experiment has actually played out because we can all access music, or like it's so much more accessible with software like GarageBand and stuff that someone that can play can get out there. And so yet we still have our Taylor Swifts or our handful of artists that like everyone rallies around because we just want to rally around that.
Well, I think there's a distinction to be made between this Neuralink music production and the AI art. Like, these are two separate ideas. AI art is not made by a human. Like, it is clobbered together by a machine who has, you know, pulled bits and pieces via some algorithm of other human artwork into a piece. So I'm perfectly willing to entertain the argument, and have in previous podcasts, that that's soulless and there's something to be, you know, disgusted by in AI art. Even if I don't yet hold that belief, I'm perfectly willing to entertain that. This Neuralink music production idea is not the same thing at all. A machine isn't making this. A machine is simply facilitating your thoughts. Like, it's still coming from the human brain. There's still a creative spark underneath that's producing this product, and the machine is just facilitating it getting written down in some particular way. And so I think in a world where people could produce music via Neuralink, we would still have pop stars. We would have styles of music, and talented people who could think the music up in a way that others can't, and they would just be able to transcribe it more easily.
Yeah, that's encouraging. I like your output, or your take on this. I adopt your outlook. Yeah.
Well, let's, before we wrap up, we've been sort of pushing it to the side the whole time, but let's indulge ourselves now in some of the dystopian possibilities, and that can be our last talking point before we wrap up. So if this goes totally awry in the worst ways, what happens? How does this ruin humanity?
Yeah, I'll jump to advertisements or just actually manipulation of free will. You know, exploiting children who are easily manipulable or forming addictive habits, I would say. But then even just compelling them to do something. If you can hack the human brain, essentially, you've really opened some dangerous doors. There's also just the like fining people or keeping tabs on people for wrong think, that's now measurable, or saying now that you've got, not even fining them, but like correcting them, right? Yeah, programming them. It would be like, why fine them? Maybe you can fine them and then you need 3 sessions of therapy. Like, because if you want to go utopian, you could say therapy, someone who's depressed, a pal, like here's a new perspective, and we can actually not just offer it up for you to pick up, we can kind of insist a perspective on you. And then you can see that goes really, I mean, that's a wry before I even finish the sentence. That's wrong to insist a perspective on someone. So yeah, it's the free will element that is in absolute jeopardy. And then who is someone who's just like, they're still a human, but they're just being, they're like, what if all their thoughts have been
pre-thought
implant? Yeah, like who is this live vessel that's not, has no sense of self, unlike anything that's ever existed?
I asked earlier philosophically, where do our thoughts come from? And we might provide an answer, you know, with this, you know, our thoughts might start coming from
be a some good device. Twist is like we're living in what seems like an everyday right now, and then you just start doing some deep digging and you learn like that you were just, you know, part of some ecosystem and designed to be, and like all your thoughts are pre-programmed and you are in Neuralink, you just didn't know it, kind of thing. Yeah. That would be a nice twist, I guess.
I could see like starting with sort of the mundane negatives. Certainly with an invasive surgery, you run the risk of infection. I mean, that's a huge problem with brain surgery anyway, or, you know, potential cognitive impairments, you know, other brain damage associated with inserting the device. But then imagine that they solve those problems and the use of this device becomes somewhat widespread. Like, what happens if it malfunctions. Like, I think about this as a software engineer all the time because things always go wrong in code. Like, what happens when it fails or goes wrong? If the device can not only read signals but also send signals, like, what happens when there's a glitch or it gets old and you have the wrong version uploaded or whatever, and you try to move your arm left but instead your leg moves right or something, and like you were driving your Neuralink car and something goes wrong. Like, you could easily imagine, like, with fine motor control, and like, you could just imagine things going wrong. So that's one thing. And then getting into the more ridiculous and scary things, like you mentioned those things, brain hacking, that sort of thing. Like, if a malicious actor could gain wireless access, because that's how this thing is communicating, right? Wirelessly through your skull to some other device. Like, if some malicious actor could get access to this thing in your brain, what kind of damage could they do? And then even further, like, right now it's connected to the motor cortex, but like you mentioned earlier, what if it was connected to, you know, different parts of the brain that control emotion? Like, you could send signals to become angry or become lethargic, or, you know, essentially shut down all of your motor function or something. Like, you could kill people, right? You could just have people kill themselves. Like, if you could
just send them into such depression that they're like, okay, you're a political opponent, give them depression where they can't get out of bed or won't get out of bed or whatever. And then, you know, all right.
I mean, and those are just overt things that would be obvious to an external observer. But what about the subtle things? Like, what if you could subtly release a little bit of dopamine whenever someone views your product, you know? Like,
yes, that'd be more likely.
You could induce addiction, by the same physiological mechanisms that drugs induce addiction. Conceivably, if the thread was connected to the right spot and you knew what to do.
It's just funny how that mirrors The Anxious Generation, the book I'm reading, and how, like, these social media companies were intentional psychologically about, like, you know, hits of dopamine and, you know, creating that dependency. Like, seriously, like, it was just like, that was their model. They were studying psychological addiction models to make it happen. So very nefarious. So, like, clearly that would be the case. Like, what you're describing is, like, they would actively pursue that. Yeah. Ugh.
And I guess, like, maybe in a less grand dystopia, but maybe the most likely one, if this becomes widespread, imagine how dependent people will be on the technology, and, like, how helpless someone without, you know, who suddenly has to go without their Neuralink device would be. Like, if you were unable to turn on your light switches with your mind and interface with all of your stuff, and you, like, how atrophied will people's muscles become, and, like, how fat will they get when, you know what I mean? Like, when everything is just done with their brain and they don't even have the caloric expenditure of, like, clicking a mouse anymore. Like, you know?
I wonder if there is some natural limits where people are like, I gotta, like, move, there's sores and stuff, I don't know. And then ironically that we're all quadriplegic, like,
right,
by choice.
Yeah, right, we're all voluntarily physically disabled, but we have our Neuralink to overcome.
Oh, the great irony of that, that's funny.
I was just thinking, though, maybe you could just hook one of those neural threads into the part of your brain that controls your, like, fever response. I mean, like, maybe you could tell it while you're sleeping to just exercise your muscles for you. And
you're actually all ripped and, like, you know, feeling great because you haven't earned it at all. So, yeah, you actually feel great. Yeah, there's no problem with
tell your body to just burn more energy wastefully, and then there you go. Now you don't have to exercise because your body just does it for you.
Weird. Via Neuralink.
Well.
So everyone still does, they look good, and they actually could walk a long distance. They're not paying any significant cost. Ugh. All unearned. Pretty strange, man.
Yeah.
Well,
that's all I have.
I'll take one.
All right, well, human trials are open for recruitment, so you can just go on to their website and sign up. I don't know whether
you need someone that's not quadriplegic just to help them with the, you know. Maybe. If you had the opportunity, would you consider it?
No. No way. Not yet. Yeah. This is like way too early. Way too early version for this. Like, I mean, once you get the surgery, once like this guy who got this first one, this is like Neuralink version 0.01 alpha, you know? Like this thing is gonna improve so fast over the coming years, and it's not like you can just snip, snap, snip, snap, remove this thing from your brain and put another one in easily. And even if they can wirelessly upgrade the firmware or whatever, like they're still gonna have hardware limitations. So now is
a good point.
Now's not the time for
unless you're a quadriplegic and you just really want to unless
that's your way to improve your quality of life immediately. I don't think so.
Okay.
That was fun.
That was fun. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.